Today's reading is on page 1030 in the Bibles on the tables and is from Luke's Gospel, chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. That's page 1030. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught.
Ian, thank you. It would help me if you can take up the multi-page handout. I apologize for the length of it in advance. So there's quite a lot of technical information that needs to be conveyed when you're talking about the reliability of the Bible, quotations from different Roman and Jewish historians, as you'll see as we go. And I just thought it'd be helpful to you to have it all in one place so that as this question surfaces time and again in the future, you've at least got a bit of paper somewhere, if you can possibly find it, where you can turn back to it and just see some of the evidence at a snapshot glance. Failing that, paper airplanes, anything you like. I've got about 3 hours worth of material, I think, but I'm determined to keep to time. One of the lawyers who works nearby said, look, it's July. You'd take 3 hours. People have got nothing else to do for the afternoon, but I won't keep you here that long, I promise. We'll see how we get on. And then I'm looking forward to your questions at the end. Now, when I speak to people about Jesus from the Bible, I tend to focus on two main areas of his life. You'll know that the foundational question in all of Christianity is, who is Jesus Christ? And one of the jobs of the Christian is to try and persuade people that Jesus is indeed the God that he claimed to be. And in doing that, we use the Bible. That's the only authority for the things that we believe. And so I focus on two main areas. First of all, his claims, and then his conduct. If you've ever read one of the New Testament accounts of the life of Jesus, you'll know that his claims are staggering. That is, he claims to be the very meeting point between mankind and God. And when he says that, he's not just speaking about some small g, piddly tribal deity from the ancient Near East. He's talking about the Jewish God. He's talking about Yahweh. He's talking about the one who is the creator of everything that is seen and unseen. And not just the creator of everything, but the controller of everything as well. The one who holds kings' hearts in his hands. The one who determines the times and the seasons. That he is the creator and the controller of everything in the world and in human history. And Jesus claims to be the very meeting point between man and that God. And so there's an occasion when one of his followers says to him, look, Jesus, if you would just show us the Father, that would be enough for us. Just show us God, and then we'll be happy. And Jesus says, look, after all of this time that I've been with you, do you still not know who I am? If you've seen me, you have seen the Father. He claims to be so full of the Spirit of God that as he speaks, the very words that he speaks are the words of God. If we listen to him, we listen to God. He claims that if we follow him, if we meet him, if we know him, then we are in personal encounter with God himself, the creator of everything. Now, anyone can make those claims. There's plenty of people in mental hospitals down the road who claim to be God, and we lock them up for it. But the thing that sets Jesus apart from the crowds is that he didn't just make these extravagant claims. He lived the kind of life and had the sort of conduct that backed up his claims. So on one day, he was walking along and came across a funeral procession. I don't know what you do if you're ever in that situation. You stand by the side of the road, you bow your head, you pay some respect to the people who are going past. Jesus knocked on the lid of the coffin and brought the one inside back to life. On another day, he was down by the beach and he had 5 loaves of bread in front of him and he broke them into little pieces as though he was going to feed the seagulls or the ducks or something. But instead of just feeding the ducks, he fed 5,000 men and their families from just 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. He made blind people see. He said words that restored the health of paralytics. He enabled the deaf to hear. classically 3 days after his own murder, he was brought back from the grave to glorious life, never to die again. Conduct that backed up his claims to go along with his wonderful character along the way. Conduct and claims which persuaded people then and continue to persuade people today that Jesus really is God. And so people then and now fell on their knees and worshipped him. You may have heard that sort of presentation of Jesus before. And if you have, you'll know that classically, your friends will see the issues straight away. Friends often say to me, well, look, if what you're saying is true, if what the New Testament says about Jesus really happened, then the implications are vast. Jesus doesn't become just a lifestyle choice that I can investigate if I want to. He becomes the God that I must follow no matter what, with my whole life. It's going to have implications for the way I raise my family. It's going to have implications for my dreams and aspirations, my career choices. It's going to have implications for my eternity. If it's all true, then I have to do what Thomas did and get on my knees in front of him and say, Jesus, you're my Lord and my God. And so the question always comes, but how do we know that it's true? As we read the New Testament today, how confident can we be that what we read is what actually happened? There are two subsets to the question. First, can we trust that the gospel writers wrote down accurate history? And then second, can we trust that what they wrote down has been accurately preserved for us? You'll see if we answer yes to both those two questions, then the question of Jesus' identity is resolved. He must be the God that he claimed to be. If they wrote down accurate history, and we have access to what they originally wrote, then as we read the New Testament, we meet God. And it's time to get on our knees before him. We'll look at those two questions in turn then. First, can we trust that the authors of the gospel actually wrote accurate history? And you'll know that the accusation abounds that they did not. Richard Dawkins isn't just an easy target. He's one of the more compelling opponents of Christianity in our generation. And so I put his version of this accusation on the page in front of you. There's a few paragraphs there, halfway through the first one. Ever since the 19th century, scholarly theologians have made an overwhelming case that the Gospels are not reliable accounts of what happened in the history of the real world. Halfway through the second paragraph, much of what they wrote was in no sense an honest attempt at history. Last paragraph, reputable biblical scholars do not in general regard the New Testament as a reliable record of what actually happened in history. In other words, you may want to know about the real Jesus of history, but we don't have access to him. They didn't even write down accurate history. And in response to that, the first thing we need to say is that the New Testament itself very self-consciously asserts that everything it wrote down was in fact historically accurate. Let me read to you this paragraph written by the Apostle John. John is the chap who wrote the fourth gospel. He also wrote some of the letters in the New Testament. He was one of Jesus' best friends. And here he's talking about the source and the content of the message that he and his friends proclaimed around the place in the first century. He said this, "That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we looked upon and have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, the life was made manifest, and we have seen it, and testify to it, and proclaim to you the eternal life, which was with the Father and was made manifest to us. That which we've seen and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us, and indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ." You see, he's going out of his way to assert the accuracy, the real life history that he is proclaiming to people. And you'll see that the stakes are high. Just in the verses there, the language is a bit technical. He's claiming that through what he experienced in history, he has fellowship with God the Father. He's mates with God because of his experience of Jesus in history. and he's claiming that as he proclaims about his experiences of Jesus in history to us, that we may share in his fellowship. So that by coming into contact with John, we come into contact with God himself. The stakes are high. Do you want to know God? Do you want to know what he's really like? Do you want him personally involved in your life? John says, because I want you to have access to that sort of encounter with God, that is why I'm so determined to make known to you things that were accurate, things that we really saw. Our own eyewitness, ear witness, hand witness experiences of God. Karen Armstrong wrote a book called The History of God, and in it she argued that what we have in the New Testament may have begun as a kernel of truth in history. But then over the period of the generations, that initial kernel of truth was overlaid by layer upon layer upon layer of myth. So that now as we read the New Testament today, we cannot be sure in any sense what we are reading is true, or indeed which bits of it may be true and which bits of it may be fantasy. And John says, absolutely not. No, the stuff that we've proclaimed to you is the stuff that we saw. It's the stuff that we heard. It's the man that we touched. We saw Jesus risen from the dead. We handled the evidence ourselves. And that is what we're making known to you. Because we want you to share the encounter with God that we had as we met Jesus. So it's reliable testimony that emerges from the community of eyewitnesses. But it's more than just that it emerges from the community of eyewitnesses. It's sometimes hard to understand this because of the 2,000-year difference. It's not that there was an eyewitness in first century Palestine who saw Jesus, and then he got on a plane and shot off to Canada across on the other side of the world. And then there in Canada, he wrote down some of his experiences from back in the first century in Palestine, and then tried to persuade a whole bunch of Canadians to believe them. People who had no access whatsoever to the events that he was describing. Actually, the very community for whom the gospel writers were writing included among them people who themselves had been eyewitnesses of the things that they were recording and passing on to others. So it's the difference between trying to persuade a whole new bunch of people that don't have access to any of the information to trying to persuade people who were there. In other words, the community contained within it people who had every opportunity to stand up and say, hang on, who are you? You weren't there. What gives you the right to write down this sort of... It didn't happen like that. No, look, he didn't feed 5,000. We just all shared our packed lunches and we had a nice day, but there was no miracle that went on. He didn't really walk on water. He was just paddling for a bit in the side. There was a sandbar there. It didn't happen like that. But no one said that. The community of eyewitnesses verified the testimony of the other eyewitnesses when they had no particular interest in doing so. If you were wanting to believe that it was all a myth, you'd be needing to believe not just that four gospel writers got together and concocted something, but that they managed to persuade all of the other thousands of people who'd witnessed Jesus and seen his miracles, and even the enemies of Jesus who were admitting that the miracles had happened, that they had to persuade all of them to go along with the myth as well. And if that's what you believe, I admire your faith. It'd be an astonishing thing to believe. No, the community proclaimed that which they'd seen, and the people who knew best accepted their testimony. Actually, when you look into it, one of the fascinating things is some of the stories about Jesus that don't get recorded in the Bible. In some of the other ancient writings, you find a story of the boy Jesus, aged about 12 or so, I think he is, and he's playing around in the dirt, as children do at the age of 12, and he picks up a lump of mud in his hand, and he molds it carefully into the shape of a bird, and then he puts it to his lips, and he blows into it, and life, this bird then flies away off into the sky. It's a wonderful story. Didn't get put in the Bible because no one was sure that it had happened. Maybe it did happen, maybe it didn't, who knows. But they left things like that out because they were determined to include only the things that they'd seen, only the things that they'd heard, only the evidence that they'd touched for themselves. One of the fascinating things, I'm not going to go into it now, you can ask me a question about it if you want to, is how modern scholarship has reversed in recent years and is now beginning to emphasize the way in which the Gospels function as accurate or seem to purport themselves to be eyewitness testimony in a way that wasn't generally thought before. But historically, some scholars have thought, oh no, they were writing myth and they knew they were. And now the evidence seems to be suggesting, as people understand these things a bit more, that actually they were very self-consciously writing down eyewitness history. Just one little example. The gospel writer Mark frames his gospel around instances of Peter, chapter 1, verse 16, and then chapter 16, verse 7. And it's as though he's saying, and then within, in between those, there's another 21 instances in which an experience that Peter had with or of Jesus is mentioned. And we've now discovered from looking at the writings of, Lucian's book about Alexander and a bloke called Porphyry's Life of Plotinus, that it's a common convention, or a relatively, in the small bit of evidence that we have, that it's a convention within first century historical writings. If you're trying to convey who the eyewitness account, who the eyewitness was that you've drawn your account from, you shove their name big and bold at the start of the book, you refer to their experiences repeatedly through the book, and then you conclude by mentioning their experiences again at the end of the book. And just one little instance of how more recent discoveries have confirmed that what Christians have always believed, namely that what we have here is accurate eyewitness history. The scholarship's been taken forward in leaps and bounds by this chap, Richard Borkham, who's written, in all honesty, quite a dull book. And unless you've got insomnia, I wouldn't recommend you necessarily read it, or if you're very much into these things. But it is an excellent book, which has moved the debate on a considerable distance in recent years. The point I've been making is some, in fact, a good portion of the material of the New Testament comes directly from the eyewitness community. Just flick over the page to page two on the handout, if you would. We're going to go more quickly as we go. You'll be pleased to know it's going to be 3 hours otherwise, isn't it? The rest of the information in the New Testament came from those who had personal access to the eyewitness evidence. And this is the reading that we had from the Gospel of Luke. So Luke, not personally claiming to be an eyewitness, but again, very self-consciously claiming to be representing accurate history to us. So you'll see the sequence of things that were there. Many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who were from the beginning eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us. In other words, lots of eyewitnesses have written it down. And it seemed good also to me, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may have certainty concerning the things that you've been taught. Again, the stakes are high. When your child is sick, when you are personally facing death, I want you to have certainty that the things that you've been taught are true, says Luke. I don't want you to be any doubt about whether this is really going to work in the face of death and suffering. I want you to know that it does. And so out of all of the other people that have written down stuff, I've gone out of my way, I've investigated all of it, and I want to write it down for you now, Theophilus, so that you can be certain. You'll see very clearly, he's not. Some people say, well, look, it happens today. I could go away and research stuff that happened in the 16th, 17th century, and I could get all of the accurate historical facts that we can gather from all of the different historians in our own generation about those times, and then I could concoct an entirely fabricated character and an entirely fabricated sequence of events, but set them in history in that way and present to you a historical novel. And you'll know that people make millions from writing those today. How do we know that they didn't do that in the first century? A couple of things. That genre of writing didn't exist for another 1800 years, 16 to 1800 years. And so you would need to be believing, first, that they invented a genre of writing, and that they managed to persuade everybody else that they hadn't in fact done that, but that they were in fact recording accurate history, and then that genre of writing was lost for another 1600 years until it was rediscovered a little bit later. Again, you're having to believe rather a lot. It's no doubt that the people who read the original documents understood that they were reading accurate history, and certainly understood that that is what the original authors wanted to convey to them. I want you to be certain, he says. So the clear evidence of the New Testament, the clear claim of the New Testament, is that when we read it, we are reading what actually happened. Some people say, look, can we set the evidence of the New Testament aside for 1 minute? Are there other documents? Are there other historians from the first century that talk about these kind of things as well? I've put half a dozen on the sheet there for you, some Roman, some Jewish. Just flick the page and let me show you the summary from not just the ones I've quoted, but all of the documents that we've got available to us from ancient history. The things that we would know about Jesus, even if we didn't have a Bible, historically speaking, you'll see these facts are confirmed. The name Jesus, the place and time frame of his public ministry, name of his mother, the ambiguous nature of his birth, name of one of his brothers, fame as a teacher, miracle worker, people called him the Christ, some considered him to be kingly, how and why, when he died, who was responsible for his death, some of the events surrounding his death, the report of his appearances to his followers after his death, the flourishing of a movement who worshipped Jesus after his death. In other words, really rather a lot of things are confirmed. I don't particularly want to lay more emphasis on the authority of Josephus to tell us what was really happening. Actually, he was writing later than the writers of the New Testament. He was writing his histories in the 90s, at the end of the first century. They're all writing 30, 40 years before that, probably. So no particular reason why he would know more than they do, but it's interesting that those texts confirm things that we know from the New Testament. Just look at how Professor Craig Blomberg summarizes it. I think it's a really helpful way of saying it. Because of when they wrote, they were able to write accurate history. Not only were they able to, clearly, when you study what they've written, they were intending to write accurate history. At almost every point that we've been able to test what they wrote, it's been confirmed that they were, in fact, writing accurate history. His conclusion, if someone wants to deny the historicity of the New Testament, then the burden of proof is shoved onto them. If at every point that we've been able to test what they're saying, it's true, why wouldn't you believe that which they wrote in other places? Down at the bottom of the page there. I guess I want to turn the question around and ask you, why would you doubt that what we have in front of us is accurate history? What would be your reason for doing that? Is it the case that you have personal access to a whole bunch of historical evidence that I've overlooked and that the rest of the Christian community has overlooked over the last 2,000 years? Have you got good reason for doubt? Or is it just that doesn't fit with what you believe already? I would never learn anything if we only believe that which we already believed. Is it just that you don't want to believe because it doesn't suit you to? Wanting to say that the historical challenge to Christianity is mistaken. You may reject it on other grounds, but I don't think you can do it on this one with integrity. First question, did they write accurate history? Second, in 1 minute, has it been preserved for us? And the charge of Dawkins is the Chinese Whispers charge. Message starts over here. It goes all the way around the room. By the time it's got over here, it's talking about something completely different. And we know that that happened, so how do we know that that didn't happen with the New Testament? And the conclusion, the counter-evidence of history, the number, the date, and the consistency of the surviving manuscripts of the New Testament, of which we've got about 24,000, some of them dating to within just a few years of the originals, confirms to us that we have what they wrote. You can read through the evidence there for yourself as we go. There are lots of variations between the 24,000 manuscripts that we've got, very minor variations. It's not the case, it's worth saying this, it's not the case that the 24,000 manuscripts went in sequence, which is what happens with Chinese whispers, isn't it? So it starts with one person here, and then it goes in a line, passing through lots of hands and ears and eyes and mouths, and then it gets to the other end of the line. What happened with the New Testament documents is that it was written originally, and then they literally exploded across the ancient world in lots of different languages, in Greek, in Syriac, in Coptic, in Aramaic, and translated into Latin and other languages as well. So they exploded to lots of different countries in lots of different languages. And though we don't have the original manuscripts that were written, we do have enough copies from across the ancient world a few hundred years later at the maximum that we're now able to cross-check between them. And if they all say the same thing, that many hundred years and that many sets of copying down the line, then you know either that they've all been changed in exactly the same way in different countries by people who had no access to each other, or that they all stem from a common source. And that's exactly what we have in the case of the New Testament. There are minor variations, but they are minor. And the science of textual criticism, to which some very people devote their whole lives, has identified for us exactly where those debates are. And commonly in the Bible, you'll see that they're referenced in footnotes where there is major doubt. There's only a couple of passages which are a couple of extended passages which are in any doubt, and those are put in square brackets in modern Bibles. The point is not that we can be 97 or 99% certain that we're reading history. It's that with 97 to 99% of the New Testament, we can be 100% certain that we are reading what was originally written. We are reading accurate history. It's time for me to stop. Look at the conclusion that Sir Frederick Kenyon puts on page 5. The interval then between the dates of the original composition and the earliest extant evidence becomes so small as to be in fact negligible. And the last foundation for any doubt that the scriptures have come down to us substantially as they were written has now been removed. Both the authenticity and the general integrity of the books of the New Testament may be regarded as finally established. I was saying on page 6 there that this question about whether or not it's true is a question about the very foundation of the Christian's life. We base everything we believe and every decision about the way that we live on the book, the Bible. To challenge whether or not it is true is to challenge the very core of our being. And I think we've seen this lunchtime, where we've begun to see that the evidence of history suggests that the gospel writers did record accurate information and that we do have today what they wrote. And therefore, that building my life upon God's word, the Bible, is secure and reliable and sensible and true and a coherent way to live. And I would have loved if we'd had 3 hours to do it, to spend a bit of time examining some of the other foundational authorities that people have in their lives. What is it that determines and dictates what you believe? That determines how you live? Intuition? What you heard from your parents? Your life experience to date? Things you've picked up from Channel 4 documentaries over the years? Some other formal religious code? And I'd want to argue that by comparison, that foundation is feeble and unreliable and unstable. And that's why I would commend Jesus to you on the strength of his claims and conduct and encourage you to get on your knees before him. Thank you for listening. We're going to take a 2-minute break and then we'll have 8 minutes of questions. If you want to scribble any down on a page, then please do so. Thanks very much for listening and bearing with us. It's not like that every week. Come back and we'll be focused in on one passage with a smaller handout, I promise, next week. Folks, I've got 4 questions which I'm going to try and deal with in 6 or 7 minutes. I know you want to get back and watch the tennis on your computer, so I better crack on and let you do that. I'll take them in order, if I may. First of all, what about the Old Testament? Very good question. I haven't had time to deal with it. The way that I understand the Old Testament, or let me rephrase that. When Jesus came, he endorsed the Old Testament. You'll know that the Old Testament had has lines like in it, like the one that Wes prayed from at the beginning, that it's precious and worth of much pure gold, that it's sweeter than honey on the mouth. It says things of itself, like the fact that it's flawless, that it's perfect in every way. So much so, and the writers of the Old Testament kept saying, this is what the Lord says, this is what God says. And so much so that you could draw an equation between what the Old Testament says and what God says. And when Jesus rocked up on the scene, he endorsed that understanding of the Old Testament. And he quoted things that we know were written by King David or by Moses or another human writer. And when he quoted them, he says, let me tell you what God says. And then he quotes the words of David. Because he himself understood the Old Testament to be 100% true and accurate and perfect in everything that it asserts, and is an equally reliable source of historical information. So the Old Testament, Jesus thought it was pretty good, and that's good enough for me, because he's God. Question two, why do Professor Dawkins, quote, scholarly theologians and reputable biblical scholars disagree with you? It's a fascinating question, that. You know how Dawkins defines reputable, how he defines scholarly? He doesn't actually tell you in the book, but as far as I can tell, it can only be people who agree with him. In other words, people who have abandoned all belief in God, he considers to be reputable and scholarly, and people who still believe in God, he considers to be irreputable and unscholarly because they couldn't possibly know anything because they believe in God, which is a classic form of an a priori argument where you decide who you like and you only listen to the people who already agree with you. It is simply not the case. One of the interesting things that one of the books we have around here quite a lot called The Christ Files by John Dixon. John's an ancient historian from Australia. One of the interesting things he writes about in this book is how on the spectrum of scholarship, there's a few people at the kind of almost nutty apologist sort of end of the spectrum who are overly literal in their understanding of everything and just get their pants in a tears every time there's a new documentary about anything. And then there's people at the other end of the spectrum who write the documentaries who don't believe anything. But the vast majority of scholars are in the middle, and there is far more consensus about the accurate history. Whether or not they believe in the New Testament, whether or not they worship God personally and believe in Jesus personally, there's far more harmony among the scholarly community in support of the historical events as recorded in the New Testament than you might be led to imagine otherwise from simply picking up and reading the latest headline in the Telegraph or whatever else it happens to be. That's a useful book to read if that would be helpful to you. In other words, those who reject what we've said, in all honesty, I respect their scholarship. I think they can only do it because of prior conclusions that they've drawn and assumptions which are inaccurate. So if you start your reading of the New Testament saying, we know that miracles don't happen, and therefore any assertion that there's a miracle must be historically inaccurate, then that's going to determine your conclusions. But if you come at the question from a purely historical point of view, and you say, well, what's the evidence of the eyewitnesses, then you're led to a different conclusion. What about the other Gospels that are not in the Bible? Do they have the same historical support? If so, should we not look at them as well? Let me refer you to frequently asked question number 4 on page 10 of the handout, where I've just done it in 3 lines. This book, Lee Strobel, The Case for the Real Jesus, these are the sort of Da Vinci Code questions which have come to the surface a lot more in recent years. And Lee has very helpfully interviewed some of the most senior scholars in this sort of field and recorded up some of the writings in there. The first 2 chapters of this book, which is also over there, deal with the question in particular. Historians, when they're considering the accuracy of sources, consider things like, when were they written? Because the closer to the events, the more reliable. Where were they written? Again, if they're written in Canada, it's not as reliable as if they're written in Jerusalem. And what about the general integrity of what they write? Does it fit with the other things that we know about political events and historical events from other sources? And when you compare the other so-called Gospels, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Peter, and other things like that, against those criteria, you understand very quickly why these were the 4 that the church settled on very quickly. So Gnosticism was a belief that didn't occur until mid to late second century, and which was a belief that there was some secret knowledge. And if you came into contact with the secret knowledge, then you could really know God in a way that no one else could. And you find that the Gospel of Thomas, for example, is flooded with Gnosticism. That tells you, if you're a historian, that the Gospel of Thomas must have been written 175, 200 AD. In other words, over 115 years after the first Gospel was written down. Therefore, not likely to be an accurate source of information about Jesus. And Lee Strobel can finish that for you if you want to read his book. Last question. I love this. This was written by someone on staff, I think. Why should I come back next week? The tennis won't be on. That's one good reason, I suppose. Nothing to miss out on there. And look, it's where we started. If that which we read in the New Testament is true, and I've begun to give you a few of the reasons why you can believe that it is, as you read it, you meet God. Now, you will meet God personally one day. Jesus assures you of that. On the day that you die, you will meet him as your judge. And he will want to know what you've done with your life. And he will want to know how you have responded in this life to the clear testimony of Jesus Christ. If you're to walk away and never consider Jesus again, you'll only have yourself to blame on that day. Wherever you're at on the spectrum of belief, from ignorance and hostility at one end to love and devotion to Jesus at the other, what you need to do if you want to consider these things, if you want to live in the light of them, is to continue to expose yourself to teaching about Jesus from the Bible so that you can meet God, so that you can know him. So that the thousands of other things that crowd into your brain and mine on a day-by-day basis to do with family and work and other things, for a few minutes in each week, are pushed to the back burner, and the one who has every right to be in the very center of your being, namely God, is put on the front burner of your mind. That's why you've got to come back, because you need to know God now for this life, and certainly for the next. Let me end by praying. Our great God, thank you that you do not want us to throw our brains out of the window and simply believe. Thank you that you have given us clear testimony in history to your existence in Jesus. And thank you that you had the Gospels written down and so well preserved through the generations, so that as we read them, we might encounter you, our living God and Creator. Pray for each one here that you would help us to know Jesus. Help us to submit to him. Help us to respond to him as he really is, not some Jesus of our imagination, but the living God himself. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.